interviewing the leading private equity executives and unlocking the secrets of success. Welcome to the Private Equity Podcast with Alex Rawlings.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Private Equity Podcast. Joining us today is Eric Steeler, an experienced private equity-backed chief commercial and revenue officer. Welcome, and thank you for sharing your insights today, Eric.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. So as we usually kick these things off, Eric, if you can give us a 60 to 90 second breakdown of you, please.
Oh, thanks, Alex. Yeah, I'll kind of skip the resume and LinkedIn speak to a lot of the detail. So, I'll cover a few things that actually aren't really covered there. I mean, from a personal perspective, lived in 8 states, 2 countries. So I've had spent some quality time in England, visited 44 states in 49 countries in my career, worked and led some amazing individuals, but I've also learned along the way for some not so great leaders and individuals. So experienced in that space. Just in general, believer in hard work, solving problems, creates great luck. From a work perspective, I would describe myself first as humble, and then collaboratively decisive, a transformational leader, like to drive change. With, I have an incessant curiosity, which helps most of the time, and a need to just measure, progress and success. Throughout my career, I've definitely been very hands-on. Utilize that path to really build experience and understand. From a career perspective, I actually started my career in product and process development. So with some large companies, C.R. Bard is now part of BD. Worked for Tyco Healthcare, which became Covidien, now part of Medtronic. So started with a good operational background, but then about the first third of my career transitioned over into that commercial role. So got into marketing and sales, really wanted to understand the customer better for a lot of things I saw. Along that career, I've managed U.S. remits, Europe, Middle East, Africa remits, and global responsibilities. I've worked for some Fortune 500. So I mentioned Covidien, which was Tyco Healthcare. I worked for Danaher Organization. I've worked in a startup of 5, so I have been marketing, sales, and about 5 other things. And I've worked in SME organizations, public, private, and PE-backed. So I've seen, a fair perspective of the market. And then really my recent love of what I've been doing in the last part of my career and keep looking forward to is those small to medium-sized enterprises that are PE or VC-backed. Just I love the ability to get involved, roll your sleeves up, and just see immediate results.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for sharing. So what's one mistake that you see either private equity firms or their portfolio companies making, and what actions would you suggest to correct them?
It's always a great question. What mistakes? Who am I to call a mistake? What I will say is I'll give a view. I'm sure some will agree, some will disagree. And really, I don't see it as a mistake. I see it more as an undervalued priority. And really what that is what is the need within a PE-backed portfolio company to drive cultural change or cultural shift early in the process to achieve the ROI they're looking to achieve? Organizations that typically become involved with PE, they've achieved a plateau of success with a current mindset and resources. PE firms, operate very different. They provide capital to accelerate that process, but what they're looking for is that solid return, and that's an expectation to have it quick. These mindsets sometimes tend to color the culture of what got that company to that initial plateau of success. So to me, the PE culture needs to be focused. It needs to be on discrete deliverables, efficiency metrics, based on how the operations. And a lot of times that can be very different from the mentality that got that company to being PE backed. So I kind of see it as that PE firm needing to really reflect on that. And is that a key part of the change they need to drive early in the process?
So excellent. And you mentioned earlier in your opening gambit that experienced sales and commercial leader, what advice would you give to PE-backed companies to support them in growing and developing, obviously, revenue?
I think the first piece I would give there is one is, do you have defined set of priorities to grow that business. You know, a lot of companies that have gotten to that point or that plateau of success, you know, tend to be very agile, but not always the most focused. You try five different things, something sticks, you drive that for a while until you find another idea, you try five more things. Once you enter that PE phase, you're really looking at ROI. You're looking at EBITDA and ROI, you know, straightforward. So it's making sure first that you've got those defined priorities nailed down to two or three, you're laser focused on those, and you're driving all of your business activities in achieving that. And the second piece is really from a core commercial perspective, looking at the structure of your commercial teams and looking at the operational structure. And what I mean by that is not just headcount, but do you have processes in place to drive commercial success? You know, spending time in Danaher companies are very focused on process. And in the commercial piece, you know, it's really, do you have a funnel? Do you have a sales process? Do you have the basic metrics? And, you know, sales is a lagging indicator. Do you have leading indicators that are telling you you're going to make your number? Is your marketing aligned with driving leads, driving that lead generation process, bringing value to the sales team, speaking value to your customer base before you're even engaging from a sales perspective? Do you have those systems in place, those processes in place, and making sure that you're driving those? And if you don't, that to me needs to be a critical focus on making sure that you're getting those in place first and foremost, to be able to ramp up that level of success as you're achieving on your initial priorities.
Makes sense. And you mentioned obviously the leading lagging indicators and that kind of sales process. What's some of the things that you see in some of the smaller businesses that you've worked in, if we just kind of look at low middle market, that would be a simple fix to implement from a, if I came into a low middle market, first time a private equity owned business, this is probably one of the bits and pieces that most of these companies are missing. What would be kind of one of those things, do you think?
I start with a CRM. Do you have a CRM in place? That's, you know, it's a fundamental tool. Second piece, how is that established? Do you have a sales process? Is your sales process there? Is it being followed? And then really I build off of that. Is your sales process a internal business focused sales process, or is it really a customer focused sales process? And what I mean by customer focus is understanding what is your customer's buying cycle and then making sure that your sales process reflects their cycle, not that you're trying to drive them through yours. It makes it a lot more efficient, you know, in the course of tracking sales. That's really the core basic set of tools. Then from there, it's really just operational. Do you have regular reviews all the way down to the ground level, all the way up to C-level? You know, you should have C-level people sitting in on your individual sales reviews. Those reviews should be weekly. Do your metrics and output support weekly cadence of activities? You can get as pedantic as number of calls in a week if you have to, but you should have some metrics that show activity, show progress, show your that your sales funnel is progressing. So you can look at sales funnel velocities. You can look at time to close between stages, time to close from acquisition to sale. You know, all of those things are good leading indicators that ultimately lead to your lagging, which is, okay, are you making a number? What is your percentage close rate, close to win rate? So having, you know, going in as a PE organization, looking at this commercial structure operationally, do they do that? Do they have those tools? Are they in place? And if not, do they have the capabilities or the resources in-house to get those in place quickly? Because that is your initial measure of success to tell you all you're going to achieve your longer term, but also tell you as you're making changes, driving different activities, driving different priorities or different market approaches, are you succeeding or failing early on, not getting that answer 6 to 12 months down the road and chewing up half a year to a year?
Completely agree with that. I think looking at the metric side of things and being able to predict future revenues on the back of it. I've spoken to so many people like, you can't do that. It's just a game of chance and a game of law of averages. And I was like, well, if there's law of averages, then the numbers need to be there and then you can see it running through. And it's something we're big on here. And a lot of the good to great kind of private equity backed businesses implement that and they can see how many bids that they've put out and therefore they'll predict how many they're going to win. One in three, one in five. So therefore they can increase churn. They can run headcount through it. They can push sales guys on the basis of numbers to hit commission bonuses, et cetera, from there. And it's absolutely critical. I completely agree with that.
Yeah, I think one thing I'd add to that, and this is usually in some of the organizations I've worked with, it's definitely missed. One of the organizations I've worked with as a PE back, they actually did a great job and it helped drive to a really successful exit for us, is looking at the marketing element of that. And that is specifically digital. Are you driving digital? In this day and age, you know, 5 years ago, digital, and from a marketing perspective, everybody saw it as, well, that's a, you know, J&J Medtronic kind of thing. In this day and age, you can drive digital off of a group of one. It's, you know, having the basic tools in place, working with a good CRM, a good backend marketing piece, tying it into a website, and then making sure that you have a way to capture visibility, either customers trying to engage with you, either softly, meaning clicks on your websites, you know, downloading of certain activities, all the way through to specifically driving content to them that is value add, but not sales oriented. So you're actually giving to the customer so that when the customer is ready to engage, they know who you are, they know the value that you're adding, and the sales process becomes a lot simpler when you're finally engaging with them.
Really. A great deal of private equity firms that I speak to, Eric, love profiles from what's regarded as world-class companies. Now, you mentioned earlier Danaher, which is always a name that if somebody goes, we'd like somebody who's comes from background of Danaher or et cetera, from that. What were your big take? You've already mentioned one of them, but what were your kind of big takeaways from your time in that business?
Great question. There's so many takeaways. I think big takeaways in relation to private equity. One is pace. You know, Danaher moves at a pace, and you know, not everybody's going to succeed at Danaher. You need to be able to operate at a pace. You know, the joke we always had in our Danaher groups was, you know, your first job is your first few weeks. You're going to have a second job as a Danaher employee. Just accept it. So, you know, it is that pace. The second takeaway really was, and I want to quote Larry Culp, and if you look at what he's doing at GE now, it's not too dissimilar what he did when he started Danaher, and it's common sense rigorously applied. And what they've done is they've taken a bunch of different common sense things and they've really put them into easy to implement tools. You know, this is part of the Danaher business system. They give you a lot of different tools to operate with, how to do things. But if you strip all of that back, they just had core fundamental tools, and it's a base set of tools, and it was problem solving, taking things down to a transactional level, the basics of 5S, getting things in the right place, getting them sorted, you know, getting those basic, easy things, eliminating waste. Yeah. If you implement just that as a private equity organization, you're already accelerating to your ROI because, again, most of the organizations that enter into a private equity situation may have some of these, but don't typically have that mindset because they're coming from a different mindset. So people from Danaher organizations are some of those things that have really focused and made lean a core piece of how they operate are great from a private equity standpoint because, you know, private equity is two things. It is accelerating sales, but it's also EBITDA. It's about doing it efficiently. And you know, most of the companies that I've dealt with or gone into that entered into private equity are ripe for just making easy, efficient moves that you can save on the bottom line without having to throw money at the problem, you know, versus throwing a mind at the problem. And that's a key takeaway for me coming from a Danaher organization that you can apply anywhere. And I really think the last piece from a Danaher organization is being flexible. And I've had roles where I've gone in, you know, my time with BioCare, for instance, I started as the head of BD and partnership, very commercial orientation. 6 weeks in, I took over R&D because we needed to get process in place. We needed to get the team moving in the right direction. I had an engineering background, you know, early in my career, let's call it really early in my career that, you know, I had to dust off. But working in companies like Danaher companies where you have to be flexible, where you tend to take multiple roles, it gets you ready for that private equity environment that change is going to come on a regular basis and you can't always throw money at the problem. You're going to have to throw, you know, smarts or resources at it. So having a team that's able to pick up, adjust quickly, make those changes. And Danaher definitely prepares their employees for those kind of operating roles.
You mentioned the eliminating waste, which is a area that's probably too regarded in private equity. The old days or the old guard that was seen as private equity comes in, makes loads of people redundant, financial engineering, business gets sold, increase EBITDA, which hopefully is now gone. But what would you recommend for businesses to look at with that understanding of lead principles for them to drive effective cost-cutting processes? What are some of the things that either you've implemented or you would recommend that business leaders look at within their own businesses?
I think when I look at the eight key wastes, probably the one I would say the most from a private equity standpoint is utilizing internal knowledge. You know, a lot of organizations getting to that point, either they usually take one or two routes. If they've got a good investment pool, they'll throw cash at a problem. Second is really, we'll just make it happen, but we're not really going to put a process around it. And really, your processes are your people. They're there. They're just not written out. So you have a lot of good resource knowledge in-house. So when you start facing some of those problems, you want to drive efficiency. It's really about starting from the ground level up and saying, okay, how do you do this? And, you know, it gets into mapping it out, which then starts driving to the other key wastes. Okay, you know, do you have over-processing? Do you have too much motion in the process? Do you have a good supply push-pull? And I'm speaking more operationally, but even commercially. You know, what's my windshield time? What's my sales call cadence of visiting customers? You know, am I doing those things efficient? But it's just starting with utilizing your people, getting the process diagrammed out, which tends to lead into every other process. And then it's diving into the process and then making it more efficient. And I think my advice to private equities in that aspect is make it a focus for your portfolio company that you need to do this. This is a priority in you. We talk a lot about different priorities when I look at things that earlier we talked about, what's the key mistake? Well, one of those pieces is, you know, when you set those priorities, as we discussed, one of those priorities needs to be for your organization to drive lean activity. And that takes time. It's one of my favorite diagrams is the diagram of the two people pushing the cart with square wheels and somebody with a round wheel going, hey, I can help you. Like, nope, we're too busy. You've got to take that time out, stop. And it's got to be a priority to make that happen. So it's utilizing that key knowledge to untap and uncover all the other waste and then just giving people the time to tackle those wastes and make the changes they need. That drives so much bottom line without having to throw a ton of cash at it. It's amazing.
Yeah, there's a great book called Work the System. First name's Sam, and I can't remember the surname. I think it's Sam, or at least Sam runs the business now. But that's something that we've implemented here is that process and looking and following that or kind of automate, delegate, delete time process, especially off my table. So yeah, completely agree with that.
Yeah, I've done start, stop, and continue activities, similar things. It's, you know, walk in, what are you doing that you need to continue to do, and what are you doing that should get better? And then the hardest question, but the most urgent question, is what are you going to stop doing? Why are you doing this and just stop doing it?
Yes, yeah, it's creating that, especially with creating those systems where people can come into your business and begin to train and learn and develop without taking huge people time intensity, but also making that engaging and process led, where it's what I regard as the bulk of it is trained via a, you know, an online platform using audio kinetic, using audio visual time learning, but then also being able to have like a manager as a block and tackler to answer what kind of questions, whereas the processes were already let out and you're not asking, oh, how do you use this system? Well, here's the video, you follow it step by step kind of process. So yeah, all that kind of stuff's absolutely essential and so regularly missed because we're all too busy, you know, chasing the next bit of revenue, growing the business and going after what we've got as the big things, whereas some of those small steps get changed. It makes it makes the whole process smoother and able for growth quicker.
Yeah, as I say, you're too busy pushing that wagon to stop and change the wheels.
Absolutely. Sorry to interrupt here. Just a quick note to highlight our new sponsor, Grata. The private equity market is rapidly shifting to a data-driven, proprietary deal sourcing standard. Grata provides the window into over 7 million middle-market private companies. Contact Grata so you can access the market first. Request a demo at www.grata.com. Now back to the podcast. we haven't spoken too much about your kind of healthcare, life sciences, medical, pharma type background. And I say that because, you know, we all interpret different areas of the, unless they call it a healthcare spectrum in the world. One of the areas I do want to talk about is because we do a great deal of searches in this space, and it's really interesting and ever kind of further invested private equity space. What are you seeing at the moment in the kind of CDMO market?
You know, it's amazing. I've seen a lot of activity probably in the last 4 to 5 years in the CDMO space. You know, my history, I spent some time in two different CDMOs, specifically focused more in the diagnostics, but, you know, both of those CDMOs did work outside of diagnostics. One of them did, you know, med device as well. One of them actually did stuff that was not even healthcare related. It kind of touched a bit of a lot of different things, but recent activities transitioning out of CDMO back into the direct piece. You know, I utilized CDMOs in a small to medium sized business that was private equity backed, and it was heavily encouraged by our private equity investors because, you know, when you're starting to look at things like product development, especially in the diagnostic space, you're getting into some pretty heavy technical areas. So, you know, microfluidics, optics, laser, unless you've got those resources at house, they're hard to find, they're very expensive. And if you're looking to get into a new space or adjacent space, once you've gotten into that space, you're strapped with some pretty heavy expenses. So you're forced to make some tough decisions. Getting into the CDMO space allows you to tap all of those resources, some of the best resources in the world, very quickly. It's an expense, so it's not a capital cost, which, you know, you can justify a lot easier. So, you know, that allowed us to look at that. And also from a manufacturing standpoint, we had certain situations in a company where we're growing so quick in our core business that we're actually squeezing ourselves out of manufacturing space for our secondary business. You're forced to either, again, drop a bunch of capital to create new manufacturing space, or in this case, you can outsource it. And you can outsource it at an expense. You're not having to carry the capital costs, and it was great. So, you know, there's that activity from personal experience, but even watching the market, having friends in both spaces now, I've seen several actions of late in larger private equities. They're actually snapping up CDMOs. And in some cases, they're just putting them, they're managing them directly as a portfolio. In other cases, there's been some recent activity where certain private equities are actually grabbing a CDMO. They're grabbing a contract research organization. They're grabbing a diagnostics company, and they're actually creating, whether they create an actual company or they just sit them together within a sub portfolio so that they can interact and coexist much better and more efficiently. There's a lot of that activity happening, and it's been pretty interesting to watch because they're tackling the future of what the diagnostic market needs, which is advanced diagnostics, getting closer to the patient point of care. And instead of waiting for one big company to get through that long pipeline, they're going to put three small companies together and say, okay, you three figure it out together. And then we can work from there, whether they sell it part and parcel or whether they just continue to invest and collapse it under one name. You know, it's their choice at that point. So it's been pretty interesting to watch in the last, let's call it 3 or 4 years, that level of activity picking up.
Definitely seeing heavy investment in that arena. So coming from a commercial sales perspective, always interested to know, what three attributes do you believe make a top performer?
Great question. I'm going through different things that I'm actually going to utilize. I think it's another one of your guests, Paul Doyle, said the same thing. You know, everybody has their own list. So this is my list. Really, for me, first, it's humility. You know, you go back to the Michael Jordan quote, you know, superstars win games, but teams win championships. And in order, you've got to be, you know, humility is the act of being human. You need to be able to relate to people. They need to be able to relate to you. So humility also gives you ability to make mistakes, you know, focus on the greater good, not just yourself. So that to me is my number one key metric. The second is actually metrics focused. Again, I'm going to steal another quote, but Peter Drucker, you know, if you can't measure it, you can't improve it. It's the only way you're going to improve. You know, people say, oh, it's a 1% improvement. That's improvement. It's better than zero. So if you're measuring it, you know where you are. You know where you're trying to go. It shows success and failure. And you know, to me, failure is a learning event. It's not a person. It's a way to know that something doesn't work. So using measurement can be a learning process for you, or sometimes it just be the kick up the backside you need to kind of take it to the next level to drive more momentum. The third for me really is customer focused. And this, I think it started in my operations days. And in commercial, you talk customer focused. Everybody says, yeah, I get it. But really, I don't speak about customer focused in terms of teams in relation to commercial. It's really focused on everyone. So my question to anybody I'm working with and I'm dealing with, who is your customer? You know, what are the things you're doing in your day that is delivering something to somebody? The customer can be you. It can be your work colleagues. It can be the recipient of the customer, the company's actions. But at the end of the day, you have to know who that person is. And then you have to have a true understanding of what their need is, because if you do, it almost guarantees success. You know, that deep understanding helps you set realistic expectations and be efficient in delivering them because you know what they need. I mean, how many times have we received something that you say, yeah, okay, this is supposed to do this, but it doesn't really do what I need. I'll figure out a different way. So, you know, that is my third piece in being really a top four a performer is being customer focused. So when I summarize, you know, humility, be a human, measure what you're doing to improve and improve and understand what your customer really needs and then go deliver that.
Love those. What do you love about the private equity industry, and equally, what do you dislike about it?
Love is a bit easier. I love the speed of private equity, the speed of change. You know, private equity puts a very defined time limit on expected return. I've worked in public companies, and yeah, you're chasing the earnings per share, and you're chasing numbers, but you know, it did happen this quarter, can happen next quarter. Private equity is very defined. I like the focus of private equity in the small to medium sized space. Now, obviously there's larger deals, there's very small deals, but there's a lot of activity in the SME space. And to me, that's where true growth can happen at a rapid pace. You know, working in larger companies, you can get growth, but it takes forever. And the analogy I always use is, you know, it's not a tanker ship, it's a speedboat. You know, trying to turn a business in Medtronic is more like a tanker ship. It's a very wide turn, but you can get there. And if you turn it too hard, you'll lose some deck chairs. Another love of private equity really is it helps great business ideas accelerate in the market against an 800-pound gorilla. And a lot of times you can do it under the radar, which is great because you're not having to deal with that competitive pressure. One of the organizations I've worked with, you know, we were the fourth largest player, but there was a chasm between the three and us. And by time the top three players figured out we were stealing their business, it was too late. You know, we had such great returns, and it was all under the radar, but private equity helped us get there fast. And then the last piece, we talked a bit earlier about that CDMO space. It's the collaboration opportunities within the complementary PE portfolio companies. I worked with a great private equity in one of my companies, and you know, they were constantly in board meetings asking us, hey, what do you need? We'd say, oh, we're working on this. I'd say, hey, actually, we've got a portfolio company over here that can help you with this. Let us get you connected. They'd connect us. We'd take off. We'd go. You know, trying to do that in a larger company, it's a lot of conversation, a lot of back and forth, a lot of, you know, are you competing against me? Are you not? Here, it's just pretty straightforward. The dislikes. Really, I'm going to come up with a couple. I mean, one, and this isn't every private equity company, but working in that space, having friends that work in that space, you hear war stories too, it's unrealistic expectation. You know, you're always going to push. And we had a saying at Danaher, it's a fine line between stress and strain. And, you know, working with private equity is really making sure they understand the market dynamics and the realistic understanding of what needs to happen inside the organization. There should always be stress, but understanding where that strain is and knowing when to back up sometimes that, okay, you're going to break it. I think the second piece is, and again, not me personally, I haven't had to experience it yet, which is great, but I've heard the war stories of integration into organizations. You know, some PE firms will feel, okay, we need to come in and direct manage. We need to tell you how to run this business. They can offer a lot of great insight, but unless you're in the day-to-day, it is hard sometimes to understand the mechanics. So, you know, finding that fine line between helping drive change, helping be a part of change, but then letting people change for the sake of change. And really, I say that it's empowering leadership to drive the change or changing management so that you have the right people to drive that change. And then the last piece kind of ties in with that. It's the polar opposite. It's the managing hope. Managing hope to me is sticking with the leadership team and hoping they're going to get it and change. You know, initially, a lot of PEs that I've talked with and worked with, or people I know that have worked with, they'll talk about wanting to limit the distraction of change, you know, especially as you make the acquisition, you're moving forward, which is understandable. But at some point, you've got to look at, okay, is there ever going to be an alignment? Is the organization going to get there to get that alignment? And if not, you got to just rip the Band-Aid off. You got to make the change and do it. So, you know, finding the fine line between those two. I think those are the main things that I would say from a dislike standpoint that I could really think about.
Yeah, it makes sense. I think your second point, dislike with regards to, you know, that kind of overbearing nature of private equity to get involved. I think some of the best private equity investors genuinely realize they are investors. They are not business owners, business runners. They're not operators, probably for a better phrase there. But I think that's where the operating partner role has benefited heavily, where the PE firm feels a little bit more in control with the expertise sitting in the PE firm, well as helping the portfolio company. So I think that's certainly benefited the industry, but yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think my red flag on that one is when you're talking with a potential partner, it's PE, and they're saying, oh, we've done three of these other, we got a great way for you to do this. It's okay, let's dig into that. And I was blessed, and one of the private equities I worked in was a great private equity. You know, we updated them regularly. It got to the point where when we'd get on calls, they would just ask us, do you need anything from us, or do you need more cash to make that happen faster? And a lot of times we said, no, you know, we're going to throw some brains at this first before we come back and ask for cash. And, you know, they'd follow up. Did you solve it? Yes, we did. Okay, great. You know, and that was a blessing. It was the right level of what we needed to be successful as a whole.
It's getting a good C-suite team in place. What are your influences, Eric? What do you read? What would you recommend that others check out?
I'm a bit of old school when it comes to that. I do a lot of reading still. You know, it's one of the few things, and I'm a hard book guy. I can't read on computer screens. I think I look at enough computers as it is. So you know, I like that. Yeah, and my reading tends to be very diverse. I like to touch a lot of things. I go back to that incessant curiosity. So I'll give you the last three things I've read, or two, and I'm reading the third. The last three things I read, actually, you know, and I saw you had, and it's not a shameless plug at all, because I love some of the stuff that you guys have done. Adam Coffey, and I know you guys interviewed him, Adam Coffey's Private Equity Playbook. I mean, it went back to Danaher concepts for me of common sense. It was just laid out very nicely, you know, it's very well explained, and I thought it was a great book. Second thing I read was, don't know if you may know this, may not, Can't Hurt Me by David Goggins. If you need to motivate to run through a wall, it's a great book to read because he will want you to do that. But, you know, it's a good story, good motivation, kind of, again, a bit of my own kick in the pants. You know, it's okay, this is great. And then the third one I'm reading right now is more theological, is The Reason for God by Timothy Keller. So just, you know, rounding out that incessant curiosity. So those are things that, you know, I'm reading right now. Like I said, my reading is pretty diverse. Podcast-wise, I've gotten into recently, started listening to more podcasts. I've been listening to a lot of the McKinsey podcasts. There's some good stuff in there, and there's a ton of content. So me personally, I've got to sift through it. Okay, is this going to be really relevant for me? Is it not? I've learned a couple of good things on there. You know, when you start getting into, you know, things like diversity and inclusion, or, you know, environmental, government, sustainability type stuff, they've got some great stuff that I haven't been around some of that at a big level to really gain. So you can gain some quick knowledge there. And then the other thing, again, definitely not a shameless plug, I've really just enjoyed the content and the interviews, is some of the Raw Selection interviews. It's been great content, and just listening to different thought leaders out there and their perspectives has been really good. Outside of that, I think the only other thing, I tend to gravitate from time to time to out-of-box thinkers. One of my favorites that, you know, I could mention, and I've read most of his stuff, and I'll watch different blogs or different posts and sites, is Richard Branson. you know, a completely different focus to business, but going back to some of the stuff we talked about earlier, the customer focus, you know, focusing 100% on your customer, but also on your team, you know, making sure that you're doing right by your team. They will make your customers right. But just his approach to things is not that always that standard business approach. It's you just flip it on its head, look at it in a different way, and you'll find some great solutions to it. So, you know, he's one of several out-of-box thinkers I like to just kind of watch from time to time and dive in and dive out when I see good content.
Nice. So quite the journey there. Adam Coffey, David Goggins through to Richard Branson. Yeah, we've got the, so obviously Adam Coffey been on the podcast twice, shared his story for both mentioned acquisitions, then driving through to exit, which he both for his books that he's driven. He's written. And then David Goggins, funny enough, we've actually got a framed book of David Goggins on the wall. He's one of our values as a business, which is mindset, which we probably for that. That's a key area for it. So, yeah, interesting. And then through to obviously a very famous Brit of Richard Branson, and obviously Virgin Airlines and what he's done there. But fascinating. Thank you very much for sharing that, Eric. If anybody wants to reach out post this podcast, how best do they do so, please?
Best, easiest way, just find me on LinkedIn. It's Eric Stewart, and you just feel free to drop me a message and be more than happy to, you know, to talk. One of the things I enjoy doing in my background is just connecting people to other people or, you know, unique problems and saying, hey, you know, have you tried this? Have you thought about that? Or talked to this person? So, you know, don't be shy. Don't be bashful. Just feel free to reach out in a message and happy to help.
Excellent. And we'll put that in the show notes as always. So, well, thank you very much for joining us, Eric. Really appreciate your insight, looking at the commercial side of things, dip into the CDMO world, and looking a little bit into the old brand name of Danaher as well. So thank you very much for everything you've shared today.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation and look forward to following you guys as we go forward. And best of luck to you and the team as well.
Absolutely. And also thanks for the plug on the podcast, which, as always, for those listening, thank you very much for joining us. Should you ever need support with your hiring to your private equity firms or your portfolio executives across Europe and North America, please do reach out to us here at Raw Selection. And if you haven't done so already, please do subscribe and you'll be notified of the next podcast, which comes out every 2 weeks. But till the next time, keep smashing it. And thank you very much for listening.
Thank you for listening to the Private Equity Podcast on www.raw-selection.com.